1243 and 20-1245. Each of the appellants will have 10 minutes for argument, and the government will have 30 minutes. I'm going to be very strict on the 10 minutes. So you do not overlap with each other. If you're saying something new, that you'll be able to get that done in the time available. I believe Mr. Smith is supposed to go first. Well, I'll read the order I have, and you can correct me. I have Smith, Hankins, Ray, Willett. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Mr. Smith, have at it.
Morning. May it please the court. I'm Grant Smith with the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I represent Raj Ramcharan. Mr. Ramcharan's sole issue on appeal is that the trial court committed reversible error by failing to voir dire for racial prejudice. Mr. Ramcharan is only pressing this claim under the non-constitutional standard of review. Under this standard of review, reversal is required when there is a reasonable possibility that racial prejudice might have influenced the jury.
Is there anything to stop you from inquiring and follow-up voir dire on that issue?
There was follow-up voir dire by the by counsel was non-existent. It was conducted solely by the judge.
Well, that's not the way we do it. And you can have follow-up voir dire in the federal court. And if they didn't do it, it's because they just didn't want to.
That's not right at all, Your Honor.
I've tried cases as a judge, as a lawyer, in the federal court for 30 years, and there is follow-up voir dire if you ask for it. Now, somebody may have told the federal public defender you can't do it. Now, I'd like to know if that's true.
I don't think there's any basis in the law for follow-up voir dire. What happened in this case was the judge made very clear at the pre-trial conference that it was going to conduct the voir dire. It didn't say what questions it was going to ask. Midway through the voir dire, counsel noticed that there was no inquiry into racial prejudice. At that point, counsel filed a motion asking the court to conduct such an inquiry midway through the voir dire. The court denied that request, preserving the claim at this point that such an inquiry should have been made. And under the standard, that denial constitutes reversible error if there's only a reasonable possibility of racial prejudice infecting the jury. And there was.
What's your case for there being a reasonable possibility? What occurred other than, you know, your client said it was that might happen?
I think there's
an indication in voir dire that was happening.
No, there's no indication. Rosales-Lopez lays out that this court considers all the circumstances when determining whether there's a reasonable possibility. Those circumstances here are that you have three of the four co-defendants who are minorities. Mr. Ramcharan is Black. It's well documented that America still harbors racial and prejudicial views against Black Americans. The Supreme Court recently has acknowledged as much when they said that this is a recurring evil that has the potential to systemically harm the administration of justice. It can't be denied that this is still a possibility that a veneer member might harbor these beliefs. The second factor is that the social context that occurred at the time. At the time, you have the highest elected official in the land, the President of the United States, making statements that are laden with racial prejudice. Not only are these statements problematic in themselves, but they also had the effect of legitimizing such prejudicial views.
So what's the best case that the factual background of your client's voir dire was sufficient to require this? What's the best case you have, the most similar one?
I think asking that question is in contravention of Rosales-Lopez. It clearly states this needs to be conducted on a case-by-case analysis.
I know it, but what we do here is you present arguments generally based on case law that where a case is similar. So we can look at it and say, oh, yeah, what Mr. Smith is saying does rise to the level of what we said in the so-and-so case. So me just asking the question doesn't ipso facto mean that you're right. I want to see another, I want to know if you know of other cases where there was a president in the background who was saying things that were racially motivated and that there was general animosity toward minorities in the courts, and that some court said, yes, those things or something like that are enough.
No, I don't have a case that's specifically on par with the facts, the unique facts of this case as before the court. I mean, never, and that's understandable. Never had we seen this sort of social turmoil as the district court in this case even.
How much did you make a record of that? Was that something argued in the court that there was this racial turmoil? And then you made a record of statements that you believed were racist made by the president. Is that in the record here? Or are we just supposed to take this as common knowledge that this was going on?
I mean, it's clearly in the record. One of the questions that was proposed was a direct quote of the president's statements. And counsel reiterated on multiple occasions that race was part of this case and that the court had not conducted.
Now, the judge explained that he would not ask, are you racially prejudiced? He thought that would not result in any sincere answers. So he said, I will approach it in another way. And he thought he was going to be able to elicit racial bias that way. Am I correct that that's what he said?
That is correct, that the court said that I'm not going to bring up race because that's not how you get an answer. However,
he thought people wouldn't answer. Go ahead.
Right. And the flaw with that reasoning is it assumes that veneer members aren't going to be honest. And they had been to this point when you brought up immigration law. People expressed their views. I think it's really important to note what questions the court did ask. It inquired whether there was any prejudice towards the military. It inquired whether there is any prejudice towards cops. It inquired whether there's any prejudice towards members of the ministry. So if there's a reasonable possibility that these sorts of occupations might be a source of prejudice for the potential juror, I think it's equally likely that there's a reasonable possibility that there's racial prejudice within one member of the veneer panel. And the government's claim that the questions that the court did ask.
The judge wasn't denying the possibility of racial bias, as I understood it. The judge had a different view from you of how to elicit that, if that's a problem. It's not considered awful for people to say they're against the military. People will say that all the time. And you don't get canceled for doing that. You do get canceled for saying you're racist. And that's why he thought he's entitled to his own common sense view of things, and may be wrong, that asking people, do you harbor bias against blacks, for example, no one's going to raise his or her hand and say, yeah, I hate black people. So do it by, is there anything about the immigration system that bothers you? Presumably someone might say, well, I don't think we should have all these people who don't share our culture. And maybe that could be pursued and say, well, that's really a racist view. But it wasn't that the judge was blind to the possibility of racism, as I understand it. It was, how do you inquire about that? And was that in view? So what I think you need to do is convince us that it was an abuse of discretion to approach it the way the judge did.
Well, it was an abuse of discretion because the standard is it has to be effective towards ferreting out any prejudice if they were armed. And in this case, the questions that the court did ask just went to prejudice in general. And the government maintains that that's effective for ferreting out specific prejudice. But the government's own conduct at trial demonstrates that that's not a sincere belief. The court asked this general question about prejudice. Immediately after, the government requested a specific voir dire on immigration law. They knew that general question about prejudice was not sufficient to actually elicit any true bias or prejudice held by the veneer men.
But were there any questions about immigration law? Were there any Any questions about bias with respect to the immigration system?
None with respect to immigrants, which is what's important. The court, at the government's request, asked about immigration law. There's no way that that would be viewed by a potential panel member as an inquiry into racial prejudice. If you look at Rosales Lopez, the trial court there did ask, do you have views towards aliens, the people, the group of aliens? And they said that was an effective way to get at prejudice. Counsel, asking about immigration.
Excuse me. Did Mr. Murray join in the objection?
I would let Mr. Murray ask that on his turn. I'm not prepared to answer, Your Honor. Right. And I'm out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Hankins, I believe you're next.
James Hankins, on behalf of Diane Ramcharan, Your Honor, may it please the court. You know, when I thought about this case and the reasons, why is it important to ask this question? Why is it important for the federal trial court to ask these questions? You know, I'm 52 years old and I practice in Enid, Oklahoma, my hometown. When I went back there in the 90s, my father came to see me work, and he showed me in the Garfield County courthouse where, when he was a kid, he remembers seeing white only and colored only water fountains in the courthouse. And this is something he experienced, and he's alive today. And he didn't have to read about that in textbooks. The U.S. Supreme Court in Loving v. Virginia, this is 1967, had to actually tell
the state. Mr. Hankins, the judge in this case went to the high school that was desegregated under Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas. Don't waste your time going through that. We all know the history, the awful history involved here. That's not the point. You have limited time. Well, I'm just making a recommendation.
Yes, well, I would concur with co-counsel's arguments, and counsel for Diane Ramcharan joined in and preserved this issue as well. As to Diane, there's another issue that relates to her, and this is, I termed an evidentiary harpoon, where the government asked one of the witnesses, Ms. Guevara, a question and elicited the response from her that Diane Ramcharan had told Ms. Guevara that co-defendant Pastor Harville was someone who had done this before, meaning someone who had committed fake marriages and marriage fraud. And that prompted a lot of discussion and objection as an evidentiary harpoon. And the reason why is 404B evidence was hashed out pre-trial. The government said, we don't have any. And so that's what upset the defense lawyers here on behalf of Diane Ramcharan. You have the specter of introducing other marriage fraud, in which my client was not charged with any of that. Now, as to prejudice, what I find telling is the government again mentions this in their closing argument, and they don't qualify it, and they don't say, like they do here on appeal, that, well, that just meant that it was a prior fake marriage concerning Diane. They didn't make that clear to the jury when it counted at trial. And so I don't think they can be heard to spin it that way in this court.
Why isn't that intrinsic evidence and not 404B evidence necessarily?
Yeah, that concerning the arguments of res gestae and intrinsic evidence, the way I read the cases, Your Honor, is that is evidence without which the jury would be confused. It's an evidentiary presentation that it doesn't complete the picture without it. And so it's required to give the jury a complete picture of what the government is alleging. In this case, the government did not allege that Pastor Harbell or Diane Ramcharan had committed other acts of marriage fraud in the past. So it was not necessary, res gestae or intrinsic, in our view.
What about the effect of the limiting instruction? How do you get around that?
Well, the way I read the Bruton versus United States cited in the brief kind of addresses limiting the efficacy of limiting instructions. In that case, it was admission, a joint trial, admission of a co-defendant's confession. And the Supreme Court said a limiting instruction would not alleviate the error there. We have something very similar here. You have kind of this hearsay statement by Guevara of my client concerning a third defendant of this, you know, alleged fraud in the past. Now, can a limiting instruction cure that? In Bruton, I think the Supreme Court didn't really set forth a legal standard. It was kind of this thought that does the error here substantially interfere with a constitutional right? And in our view, it does. There's a constitutional right to a fair trial and to be tried based upon the specific allegations in the indictment. And in this case, they do not include other acts of marriage fraud that were injected here. So I would say a limiting instruction.
Why was it so obvious that this is referring to multiple prior occasions? There was evidence that he had engaged in a prior marriage involving the same one of the defendants. Why did the jury have to think that this question referred to even additional questionable marriages?
Because it was vague and open-ended.
That raises the possibility. It also lessens the prejudicial impact, doesn't it?
Well, it does not.
If he had testified, if the testimony had been on this occasion he did it, on this occasion he did it, on this occasion he did it, that could have a substantial impact on a jury saying, okay, this guy's in the business of doing that. But a vague statement like that, I would think would be less prejudicial, which would also mean that an instruction could be more useful.
We disagree. No?
Okay.
The vague nature of the question, it leaves the jury to speculate on what that means. And remember, it's the government asking the question here. If the government wanted to say, well, did Diane Ramcharan tell Ms. Guevara that Pastor Harbell committed a fake marriage involving Diane in the past, that would probably be fair. But this speculative, you know, just these fake marriages, he's kind of in the business of doing that is the implication, the clear implication just reading the transcript. And I see I have 2 minutes. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes if we could, unless there's questions.
Okay. And what we'll do is we'll pile up the reserve and then the four of you can decide who should use that time, but you're certainly welcome to. Next, I think we're at Mr. Gray. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court. I'm here on behalf of Galima Murray, asking that his convictions and sentences be reversed for three reasons in our briefing. I'd like to talk about two of them today. Briefly, and Mr. Smith covered the racial voir dire questions extensively, I just want to be responsive to a few things the court raised. Judge Kelly, I know you had a question about whether Mr. Murray joined in the request. Does the record reflect that he said the words, "I join in the request"? No, it does not. I have to say that is not the case. Respectfully, I believe under the unique circumstances set forth in this case that does not matter. And I would invite the court to examine the authority we cited on page 23 of our opening brief and pages 2 and 3 of our reply brief. And when we look at Rule 103 and the policies underlying that rule, the request was specifically made to the court, and it invoked Mr. Murray by name. In the making of the request and the reasons that this voir dire was required here, that it was specific and it mentioned Mr. Murray by name. So under those authorities that we have cited in those portions of our opening brief and our reply brief, Mr. Murray's position before this court is that the request specifically made by Mr. Ramcharan's counsel, since it invoked him by name as a part of the request, respectfully, we submit that that is and should be sufficient to preserve the issue for appellate review. Now, I also want to talk just briefly about, as I read Rule 24 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure.
What? I'm sorry.
Rule 24. Really badly. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Tremendous echo every time you talk. So I didn't even know your name initially until I heard it.
It sounds like you're in an echo chamber when you're speaking.
Yeah.
So what you can do about it, maybe turn down the volume a little bit.
Certainly.
I don't know if that'll help.
I'll turn down my volume too to try to stop it.
Let me move closer. Does that help?
Yes.
Any?
Yes.
Does that help?
Yeah, I think it does.
Is the court okay? I'm just moved closer to the microphone. Hopefully that helps the court hear me a little bit better. And Your Honor, I apologize if the court hasn't heard anything I've said or had difficulty for that. The point I was beginning to make is as I read Rule 24 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, it is not mandatory that the attorneys be allowed, as that rule exists now and at the time of trial, to conduct follow-up voir dire. And I think the record makes clear that what happened here is that the court indicated it was going to conduct the voir dire. Now, the rule requires that the attorneys be allowed to submit additional questions that they want the court to ask. And I think that did happen here, and the court didn't ask them. So as I read Rule 24A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, as it existed at the time of trial, I think the trial court has the option to say either that the court itself can conduct voir dire, or attorneys can do so. If it elects to do it itself, the court has to allow written questions to be submitted to it for supplementation. That happened here.
Council Rule 24A2 says the court must permit the attorneys for the parties to ask further questions or submit further questions that the court considers proper.
And so I believe, Your Honor, what the record plays out here is that the court followed 24A2B, and it opted to follow that tact here and say, I'm not going to allow the attorneys to ask supplemental questions themselves. I am going to consider additional written questions, which is what I believe happened. And I believe that's when counsel for Mr. Ramcharan submitted these written questions. The court considered those on the record and just refused to give those.
Did anybody object to not being permitted to ask follow-up questions?
I don't know if that specific objection was made, Your Honor, that I'm aware of, but I think the court had the ability to opt for the procedure that it did employ under the text of the federal rule, and where these questions were submitted by at least Mr. Ramcharan's counsel. And when the court took this up on the record, as I said, he mentioned Mr. Murray by name. I submit that that is sufficient to preserve the issue here. And that raises the issue properly before this court. And briefly, I'd just like to talk about the other issue to focus on today, which is the court's failure to take judicial notice of the fact that that recruiter was a military occupational specialty in the United States Army. Now, what we had here is the government placed pretty significant evidence as to my client, as to Mr. Murray, that his spouse, Diane Ramcharan, didn't know what his MOS was. There was quite a bit of questioning about that. The immigration agent that testified to that talked about his own experience in the United States Army, indicating this is just basic information that any person would know that was actually involved in a legitimate relationship. Now, what we had here is we had Mr. Murray's trial counsel put forth a document from a government website, and under this court's renewable fuels decision, if that is the proper subject of judicial notice.
Well, now, how was it material?
It was material, Your Honor, because that was significant evidence as to the circumstances involving Mr. Murray himself and his marriage to Diane Ramcharan. That was...
The fact that he had an MOS of X, Y, or Z made no difference whatsoever to his testimony or to what he had done.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because the agent testified that I went to interview her, and one of the key ways that a red flag I saw is that she didn't know what MOSs were and didn't know what her husband's MOS was. Now, what the significance, Your Honor, is he was a recruiter at the time. In fact, Mr. Murray was, and he had gone through the training to attain that military occupational specialty.
Does that have anything to do with whether he was legitimately getting married to her or legitimately receiving housing expenses, et cetera?
Your Honor, it goes to her knowledge of what he was actually doing, and the way it was used by the agent and portrayed by the government at trial is this is strong circumstantial evidence. This woman doesn't have any kind of relationship with him because she doesn't even know the basic facts about his military job. That's what an MOS is. It's the job that you hold at a given point in time in the armed services.
Let me ask you this about that. So what did trial? So when this government agent was up there stating things that trial counsel apparently knew were demonstrably false, did he cross-examine him on it, or did this judicial notice idea come up later? Just did he choose not to ask any questions, but just wanted to introduce that?
I believe, Your Honor, that he asked questions about it, and the agent simply indicated, you know, you're wrong. And I think, Your Honor, it was a situation where this agent had been in the Army sometime earlier. And so what we had was maybe when this gentleman was in the Army in the 80s, that wasn't the case. But we had the documentary evidence there at the time of trial from the government website that said that was the case. And then we set forth in our...
So it seems to me that the sole purpose of this document was to impeach the witness. And that's impeachment on a collateral matter, which can exclude. Why is not the sole purpose of to impeach the witness on a collateral matter?
Your Honor, it showed that a key part of the evidence as to Mr. Murray in the case they were building against him just wasn't accurate. And that Diane Ramcharan, when she answered that he held a recruiter role, that she was identifying a military occupational specialty that was, in fact, his military occupational specialty at the time. So that is not, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree that that is a collateral matter when it was cited and used at trial as a significant part of the evidence that this particular marriage between Diane Ramcharan and Kalima Murray was not valid.
Wasn't there evidence that his MOS was tanker?
May I respond to that, Your Honor?
Yes, you may. Go ahead.
I believe that was an MOS that he had attained at one point in time. I believe, Your Honor, you can get a different MOS at a later point in time by doing additional training. And so the issue is that this agent was saying this just isn't an MOS at all. And the fact that she identified something that isn't an MOS at all is evidence that she just doesn't know what in the heck she's talking about. Ergo, this is fraudulent. So when we had evidence that it actually was an MOS in the Army documents, that's why it was important and material.
Thank you. Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Willett, you've been waiting patiently. Now you have your 10 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. Jonathan Willett for Pastor Ken Harvell. And I just want to begin, even though it's not my issue, just to address something Judge Kelly brought up regarding the voir dire. And Judge Abell was pretty firm that we were not, I was one of the trial counsel. He was firm that we weren't going to be able to ask any questions of the
jury.
Did you
register an objection?
It wasn't my issue.
You were going to try in the case. Didn't you want to ask follow-up questions?
He permitted us to pose written questions that he was going to do. And personally, I didn't want to upset anybody. It wasn't my issue.
Okay.
But he was firm we weren't going to be allowed to ask any questions. And I just wanted to clarify that because I was trial counsel. But it's not my issue because my client is Caucasian. That said, I do want to touch on this 404B issue that Mr. Hankins first addressed. And the perspective I'd like to inform the court of is that we had a motions hearing on this on June 26, 2019. And on June 26, 2019, the court, and it was a different judge, it was Judge Brooke Jackson, he indicated that the statement was entirely inadmissible, that that Mr. or Pastor Harvell had performed these types of marriages or fake marriages before. He said it was completely inadmissible. The government confessed that it had no 404B evidence, that it wasn't going to admit the statement. The same attorneys for the government did that. They didn't raise the issue of it being extrinsic or intrinsic or res gestae. They just confessed the motion, and the judge added some points, which were, this is a statement about which she has no personal knowledge, so she's not competent to testify to it. And it also isn't proper hearsay under Rule 801. So it was, and I think Mr. Hankins called it a harpoon. And I guess why it might be called a harpoon is because, I mean, the law of the case, the rulings were, it just wasn't going to come in. And then the government obviously wanted to introduce it. It's a big part of their case. Not only did they want to introduce it after we had those objections based upon the rulings of the court at the motions hearing, the government had the court reporter read the answer to the question back several times. So obviously it was a big part of their case. And to address Judge Hartz's question, well, maybe they're just referring to the prior marriages. Well, I guess that might be if you assume the prior marriages were also fake, but we're supposed to assume the prior marriages. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I thought the testimony was he had done that when he was being, when one of the people to get involved in the charge marriages was questioning the procedure. He was told, she was told, I'm sorry, I'm not getting this straight, sure, that he has done this before. And there was evidence in the case that he had done a marriage before. When you say this, it's not clear whether that means a fake marriage or a marriage of convenience for an immigrant or what. It's just, it's so vague, and there was something very that had happened before.
Well,
why is that so damaging, so prejudicial?
Well, it wasn't so vague. It wasn't so vague to us because I wanted it excluded. The court excluded it. The government wanted to read it back a few times.
Let me ask, what was excluded? I thought, was it that specific statement by the witness?
Yeah, I raised it in a motion.
A general exclusion of you can't get go into the fact that the pastor had done this many times before.
No,
it wasn't a more general exclusion.
I put the little sentence in the motion, and that was what we debated at the motions hearing.
And Judge Jackson specifically excluded that statement.
Exactly. And essentially why it's prejudicial is because it makes it sound like he's the guy you go to in Colorado Springs when you need a fake marriage. And he may have been, but we're not supposed to presuppose that. We're supposed to suppose he's not that guy. We're not supposed to presuppose he's guilty because he's the guy that does all these fake marriages. That's the whole point of the 404B rule is to give some import to the presumption of innocence. And that's not what was done here. So I don't know if you want me to address this extrinsic, intrinsic res gestae argument, but the government didn't make that argument in the lower court. I think it's waived. And in any event, if it's not, this statement is external to the allegations of the indictment. It's very external. It's not related in time. It's not related in place, and it's not related in substance. It's just a prejudicial remark that was bad character, essentially indicating in a very open-ended way that essentially, Mr. Pastor Harvell was the fake marriage shop for the Springs.
But they were trying to talk this woman into participating.
Sure.
And to alleviate her concern, say, well, he's done it before. He did. He did it with Mr. Murray. He did it with several of these people involved in this case. So isn't that making it intrinsic?
Well, I don't think so, because it has nothing to do with the acts of the of the defendants to submit fake applications. It may have been a point in which someone's trying to convince someone else to join, but it's one of 1,000 points that were given to her. Mm-hmm. And it was just not very probative in terms of convincing her to do it. She, and that's not even an issue, really, in terms of the elements and things that need to be proven, that she needs to be convinced she'll be safe.
Now, what about the limited instruction that was given?
Well, that's a hearsay instruction. It's not an instruction limit, a 404B instruction. It's just a hearsay evidentiary instruction that it's not offered for the truth of the matter asserted. It's not a 404B limiting instruction. And frankly, I mean, if I were to go to a layperson and say that shouldn't be admitted for the truth of the matter asserted, they're going to go, what the hell does that mean? Excuse my French, Your Honor. but I want to get touch a little bit with maybe a little bit about this whole mental state of my client. He was, in a really deteriorating mental condition. We had a lot of credible witnesses to talk about that. General Harvell, it's like one of the chiefs of staff, other witnesses who saw him at the church. And this guy has a pretty severe degenerative mental health condition. No one was making a diagnosis. They were just going to talk about their observations during the period of time. And I think that was important for the jury to understand about this guy's mental state. I mean, he's all over the place and he doesn't have this kind of formulation of intent that the government wanted to present. So, and I just think that the court excluding that and excluding all the evidence about his, you know, sincere religious beliefs and how he approached all that really affected our ability to address the mens rea proof in this offense. And I will preserve 24 seconds for my rebuttal if the court's okay with that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to preserve it for somebody.
Okay. Well, for our joint call.
But I'll take a few seconds to answer a question. You were wondering why Mr. Hankins referred to a evidentiary harpoon, and it's because he practices in Oklahoma, and that's a term that appears in Oklahoma appellate decisions, hear that from Oklahoma attorneys fairly often. Is that correct, Mr. Hankins? I think that's, yeah. So it wasn't a term that surprised me, but you don't hear it from Colorado counsel.
Yeah. Thank you, Judge.
Now we're ready for Ms. Miller. You have a half hour.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Marissa Miller, and I represent the United States. After a 9-day trial, a jury convicted these defendants on nearly all of the charges against them. In this appeal, the defendants raised 8 different challenges to their convictions, but none of them warrant reversal. The first issue in this case is whether the district court committed reversible error when it declined to ask prospective jurors about racial bias directly. In answering this question, the government would urge this panel to focus on 2 different comparisons. The first comparison that's important here is between the questions the defendants requested at voir dire and the ones that were actually asked. The question the defendants wanted the district court to ask was whether the race, religion, or ethnicity of an immigrant would affect the jurors' thoughts on whether that immigrant should be welcome here. In other words, the defendant's primary concern was that a juror might be prejudiced against certain groups of immigrants. Ultimately, what the district court asked the jurors was whether they personally held strong views on illegal immigration and whether there was any reason they couldn't be fair or impartial in a case involving illegal immigration. So while the district court didn't pose this question in precisely the way the defendants wanted, the jurors were still asked questions that encompassed the defendant's concerns about prejudice in the immigration context. This is especially true when we remember that the defendants were present in the room during voir dire, where the color of their skin would have been apparent to prospective jurors. Practically speaking, then, any juror who was prejudiced against certain groups of illegal immigrants or immigrants would have known to speak up in response to that question.
Do you think they really would speak up?
I mean,
asking directly.
I don't think that asking the question directly versus asking it in a slightly more indirect way would probably change the likelihood of the result. You know, if someone wants to conceal that, they likely will. I do think what's important to note here in this case is that, unlike in Rosales Lopez, that question was also asked of the jurors somewhat privately through the juror questionnaire. So while it might not be acceptable to speak up about those prejudices while voir dire is occurring, the jurors actually did have an opportunity to really share their honest opinions on the subject. And really, that's all you can ask of a jury during voir dire.
Do you think that they were reminded of them, of the issue, that it would make them more conscious to avoid it?
So certainly the Supreme Court's decision in Rosales Lopez talks about the pros and the cons of asking directly about racial bias. And, you know, the cons, which Judge Ebell recognized, are, you know, when you ask a question about, you know, President Trump's comments on illegal immigration, you really risk turning a trial into a referendum on, you know, the politics of illegal immigration or perhaps, you know, the presidency. So, but yes, the Supreme Court obviously has acknowledged that there are pros and cons, and certainly Rosales Lopez indicates that probably the wisest course is to let the defendant make the decision about whether that question should be asked. But Rosales Lopez is also very clear that when the district court opts to ask that question in a different way, that is not grounds for reversal. So the second comparison that's key here is between the facts of this case and the Supreme Court's decision in Rosales Lopez.
You want to speak up, please?
Sure. So the second comparison that's key in this case, is that better?
Oh, yeah, a little.
Is between this case and the Supreme Court's decision in Rosales Lopez. because these cases are very similar, the outcome here is essentially dictated by the Rosales-Lopez decision. Both of those cases involve people of color who were charged with illegal immigration-based offenses. In both cases, the district court declined to ask about racial prejudice expressly, but still chose to address it indirectly by asking about immigration and prejudice more generally. In fact, the questions the district court asked in Rosales-Lopez were very similar to the ones asked here by Judge Ebell. In Rosales-Lopez, the district court asked whether the jurors had any particular feelings about illegal immigrants and if there was any reason they couldn't be fair or impartial in a case on the subject. In both cases, the district court also removed several jurors based on their answers to these questions. The Supreme Court said that the district court's actions were enough to eliminate a reasonable possibility that race might influence the jury. And because this case is on all fours with Rosales-Lopez, the same result is required here. I think the last point I'd like to make on this issue is that it is very telling that the defendants really haven't cited, and the government has been unable to find, any case in which a trial was reversed on this ground. I think that really demonstrates that while the reasonable possibility standard might seem easy to meet when it is divorced from both the facts and the analysis in Rosales-Lopez, the reality is that as long as the district court takes steps to address the concerns raised by the defendant, as long as there's no indication that racial prejudice really did affect the trial, as long as some jurors were removed on this basis, then really, you know, those concerns were sufficiently addressed and reversal isn't warranted. I'm happy to answer additional questions about this issue, but if there are none, I will turn to the Rule 404B question. And so that's the second issue in this case, and it's essentially about Ms. Guevara's testimony that Mrs. Ramcharan told her that Pastor Harvell had, quote, done this before. And the main reason the court to reject this claim is simply that Rule 404B is about evidence of prior bad acts. It doesn't cover intrinsic evidence, which is essentially evidence of acts that are actually part of the crimes that were charged here. So in this case, we have Mrs. Ramcharan saying that Pastor Harvell had performed a ceremony for her before. As the district court understood this statement, Mrs. Ramcharan was referring to her own marriage to Mr. Murray, which she'd already told Ms. Guevara about and which the jury had already heard that Pastor Harvell also officiated. So Rule 404B doesn't apply to this testimony because that ceremony wasn't a prior bad act. It was actually part of the basis for both count two and count four. To the extent that Mr. Willett argues that the government didn't preserve this, I would ask the court to look to volume six, pages 340 to 41, which is the district court's ruling essentially saying that it doesn't fall under 404B because it's not other acts evidence. And in fact, the government used the word intrinsic. Regardless, of course, this court can affirm on any ground. But I think that ultimately the defendant's challenge to this testimony relies on this idea that Mrs. Ramcharan's statement was susceptible to two interpretations. One, that Mrs. Ramcharan was just talking about her marriage to Mr. Murray, which is how the district court interpreted that statement. And the other, that this was some sort of vague allusion to the idea that Pastor Harvell had done this many times before with other people. And, you know, the problem with that argument is, one, that's not how the district court understood it after sitting through the trial, hearing the testimony with all the appropriate context. And the district court is entitled to deference there. And perhaps more importantly, when we're performing the Rule 404B, 403 analysis on appeal, this court is required to give that evidence its least prejudicial interpretation. So whereas here it's potentially ambiguous, the tie essentially goes to the least prejudicial option. Second to last point I would make is that essentially even if this evidence did fall under 404B, it still wasn't offered as propensity evidence. The district court clearly instructed the jury that it couldn't consider this statement as evidence of what Pastor Harvell had actually done. Its only relevance was as to what Mrs. Ramcharan told Ms. Guevara during this conversation. And we on appeal, the assumption is that jurors follow those instructions, and the defendants really haven't presented anything that suggests otherwise. To the contrary, if the concern is that Pastor Harvell is going to get convicted on the basis of the statement, Pastor Harvell's acquittal that relied on Mrs. Ramchand's marriage to Mr. Murray suggests that the jury didn't really pay any attention to this statement in terms of holding Mr. Harvell liable for it. You know, I know Mr. Willett talked a lot about the pretrial rulings, and kind of the history of the statement is a little confusing. I'm happy to talk about that further, but part of the confusion essentially comes from the fact that there was a James hearing on...
Slow down a little bit.
Sorry, Your Honor. There was a James hearing, and the government proffered what they believed Ms. Guevara's testimony was going to be. And at that time, the government believed that Ms. Guevara was going to say something to the effect of, Pastor Harvell has done this before for other congregants of his church. And the district court said, I'm going to exclude that unless you can provide some sort of foundation for personal knowledge. And what happens at trial is that Ms. Guevara says something slightly different. She just gives this vague statement that Pastor Harvell has done this before. And I think, you know, regardless of the defendant's concerns about what happened beforehand, those concerns were raised to the district court and rejected. And perhaps more importantly, on appeal, all that really matters is the evidence that came in and how it was analyzed under Rule 404B and Rule 403. So really, those pretrial rulings are essentially irrelevant. All we're really looking at is Ms. Guevara's statement, which was vague and which the district court properly interpreted as outside the scope of 404B, and which the district court also instructed the jury that it couldn't use in this impermissible 404B propensity inference kind of way. I'm going to jump ahead to the sufficiency of the evidence claims brought by Pastor Harvell.
What about would you address the recruiter issue?
Of course. Mr. Murray has argued that the district court abused its discretion when it declined to take judicial notice of the fact that a recruiter was an MOS. I think several points in response to this, which is that Rule 201 is specifically about adjudicative facts, which are the who, what, where, when.
I'm specifically interested in the relevance.
Sure. So essentially...
But the admissibility, not the judicial notice component. I think it's clear that you can take judicial notice of a document like this, I think. I'm more concerned.
So,
should have been admitted.
I guess I would disagree with the idea that you can take judicial notice of this document. But to address the relevance specifically, I mean, I think that it's very important to recognize how collateral this is because, you know, if you ask someone to explain why is it relevant that a recruiter is an MOS, it really takes you two paragraphs and 5 minutes. It's a long story. And the reality is that what wasn't really relevant was whether a recruiter was an MOS. What was relevant is that Mrs. Ramchand had no idea that her husband's MOS was Tanker. And that during the same conversation, she revealed that she didn't even know what city in Maryland he lived in. This was all sort of part of a lot of evidence that Mrs. Ramchand didn't know what was going on. So the fact that, you know, she incorrectly said that that the investigator incorrectly said.
It seems to me if part of the way she was impeached, she didn't even know she mistakenly thought her husband was a recruiter when he was a tanker. And in fact, he was a recruiter. And the cross-examination was he couldn't have been a recruiter because that's not even an MOS. Yes, it takes a while to explain these things, but the government had taken a while to explain these things to try to make her look uninformed about her purported husband. And
I think in that sense, the cross-examination is really important to look at here because the government, you know, this witness does make a big deal about the fact that she doesn't know that a recruiter is an MOS. But then on cross-examination, Mr. Murray, you know, says, okay, well, what was his job title? And she says he was a recruiter. And then he asked the agent, during cross-examination, it was made very clear that he was a recruiter during this time, as well as the fact that, counsel very effectively pointed out that the agent's judgment that a recruiter was not an MOS was incorrect. You know, counsel says, are you aware that Recruiter became an MOS in 2018? And would you be surprised to learn that? And he says, you know, like, I would be surprised to learn that, but I have to take your word for it. And the reality is, the reason we have this rule against impeaching witnesses through extrinsic evidence is that that's the appropriate way to do it, is through cross-examination, as you cast doubt on the witness rather than trying to do a trial within a trial on, you know, what time frame.
So it was pursued on cross-examination?
Yes.
The fact that it was in MOS. Okay.
Yes, and counsel made that very clear. And I think that was one of the reasons that the district court chose not to take judicial notice, was that the jury understood that that statement was now very questionable.
Did counsel on cross-examination pull out that document that he wanted the court to take judicial notice of and present it to the agent?
He did not. He certainly could have. I don't think he discovered that document until later in the trial. But I do think that was also one of the reasons that the district court didn't want to take judicial notice of this fact, because, you know, Rule 201 is about facts that are beyond reasonable dispute. And so here, during cross-examination, the question is, you know, did you know that Recruiter became an MOS in 2018? And then he comes back the next day and says, Recruiter has been an MOS since 2003. And the district court said, okay, you know, I'm willing to consider this. Can you provide me with proof that a Recruiter was an MOS from, you know, 2010 to 2017 relevant timeframe? And that never happened. And that is a threshold requirement for judicial notice.
You were going to address sufficiency of the evidence. I'm particularly interested in the sufficiency of the evidence that Harville was party to the false statement.
So I think the key to understanding the sufficiency of the evidence for count three, it ultimately goes to the sufficiency of the evidence for count four, because the jury was instructed on Pinkerton liability. So as long as there's essentially sufficient evidence to hold Pastor Harville liable as a member of this conspiracy, the false statement comes in as a reasonably foreseeable part of that conspiracy. So I think the larger evidence here, and perhaps the most damning evidence, is Ms. Guevara's testimony that Pastor Harville was in on the whole thing, that he understood that her marriage to Mr. Ramcharan was fake. He jokes about it during the ceremony. He encourages her by telling her she's doing God's work. And then after the ceremony, they all go to lunch together, where they have this conversation about how everything's going to work. You know, they're talking about how Ms. Guevara is going to get her mail forwarded to Pastor Harville's house. They sign this lease that shows that Mr. Ramcharan and Ms. Guevara are going to pretend to live in the Harville's basement. And they talk about staging the basement so that it looks like Mr. Ramcharan and Ms. Guevara lived there. And, you know, if it's helpful, the record sites for this are volume six, pages 354 to 359. And, you know, I think in addition to the rest of the evidence about Pastor Harville's involvement, there was essentially ample evidence for, you know, again, it's sufficiency of the evidence. The standard is quite deferential to the jury's verdict. All we really need is, you know, enough evidence that a reasonable finder of fact can conclude that the defendant is guilty. We have ample evidence that Pastor Harville is part of this conspiracy. And because the jury was instructed on Pinkerton liability, this false statement in Mr. Ramcharan's immigration form is, you know, well within the scope of Pinkerton liability. But, you know, the direct evidence under that as well, it's, you know, the false statement in the I-45 is all about this claim that Mr. Ramcharan is living in the Harville's basement, and Mr. Ramcharan attaches this fake lease that, you know, according to Ms. Guevara, Mr. Harville was there when the fake lease for his own basement was signed. And that's part of his application. So it's very difficult not to infer from that evidence that Pastor Harville really understood exactly what was going on, that he had essentially offered his home up as this lie that Mr. Ramcharan could rely on to demonstrate that he and Mrs. Ramcharan were divorced and he was living with his new wife somewhere else. You know, and then when we throw in Pastor Harvell's conversation with the federal agents, you know, his responses are not the responses of an innocent man. Mr. Willett claimed throughout trial that...
Were there any other issues that you wanted to, or was that the sufficiency of the evidence that you wanted to address?
I can also talk about Mr. Murray's sufficiency claim, but I will let the court direct me wherever it would like to go.
Well, let's see if there are any other questions from members of the panel. I don't have any further questions. Anyone else?
None for me.
You still have time, but we don't have any questions at this point.
Then I will happily cede the remainder of my time and ask this court to affirm.
Okay. What I'm going to do, I think Mr. Hankins had another minute or two, and Mr. Willett had about a half a minute. And I don't think the other defense counsel had time, but I'm going to give Mr. Smith 2 minutes to respond on the Rosales-Lopez issue.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points I'd like to make. The first being that the government points to the juror questionnaire questions as providing a forum to vet out any racial prejudice. These questions asked about the issue of immigration. And I think it's very important that these were given to the potential jurors before they had ever seen the defendants. They had no idea that there would be minority defendants in this case. Asking about potential issues without knowing that critical fact is really inefficient to get to potential racial prejudice. And the second point is that the questions that the court does have the discretion to go about this in another way. The court could ask the question about Trump, which might have gotten people talking about it. It could ask indirect questions, but they have to go to this issue of racial prejudice. And the questions here were not specific enough to uncover any such bias. Even the government believes that. We're in the situation where the government got its inquiry into the specific bias that concerned it, but now claims that Mr. Ramchand should be happy with these general questions about prejudice in general. And that's not the case. He should also get the inquiry into specific racial prejudice, whichever way the court wants to go about it. And for these reasons, I would respectfully request that this court vacate Mr. Ramchand's conviction and reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Hankins, do you wish to say anything additional?
Just briefly, Your Honor, I think maybe getting lost here is the purpose of voir dire. It's for to assist advocates in picking the jury and utilizing challenges. These, what I call just general, are can you be fair questions, do not do that. You have to ask the jurors, what do you believe, and then go from there.
Thank you. And Mr. Willett? Or had he already used up all his time? I thought he had some time. I thought he reserved some time.
I had 24 seconds, but I'm wondering if the court might give me 90.
It is 60.
60? Okay.
Do it 60.
Thank you. Thanks, Judge. The first thing I wanted to emphasize is that Mr. Harvell sits in a completely different position from the other defendants. He was acquitted of half the charges. And the evidence, a lot of the evidence related to other defendants' actions, not his. The second thing I'd like to address is that the government indicates that this statement about other marriages related to Diane Ramcharan, but if it did, she would have said, he did it for me. And she didn't say he did it for me. She said other marriages. And then I guess my concern there is that if the jury acquitted him of her marriage as being false, then it clearly wasn't applying that information to her marriage. Lastly, on the Pinkerton liability, I just want to say that Ms. Guevara did state Ken did not know to the investigating officers when she was first interviewed, and that this lease signing, the lease was signed purportedly by Vivian Harvell, whose name was misspelled multiple times on the document, and it was clearly a forged document that the Ram Charan submitted saying the Harvell.
I gave you 60 knowing it would end up being 90. You had 93 seconds, so I think you've been treated fairly, Mr. Willis.
Thank you, Judge. I apologize.
Okay. Case is submitted. Counselor excused. Court is in recess until 9 tomorrow morning Mountain Daylight Time. And but if you could keep the judges on for a moment so we can schedule our conference.
Sure thing. Thank you, Your Honor.